So quick to choose the path walked by the righteous, so you can go and nest among the weak. The innocent observers will refuse to find the lie within. Renew the disappointment of the meek.
Chapter 3. Chapter warning for fairly intense grief, and specifically the grief of an unborn child. It's not like Peter has any idea how to go about training a human child, but he figures that the first things he needs to concentrate on are strength and stamina. "How many push-ups can you do?" he asks, looking at Styles' skinny arms with some skepticism. Styles just shrugs, so Peter tells him to just do them until his arms get tired. He does 15 before stopping. Peter has no idea if that's good or bad, but tells him it's fine. He can do 15 every day for a week, and then they'll go up to 20. He certainly has more than enough energy to run around. They settle in Albuquerque for the first month. They hike in the desert and the mountains. Peter teaches him how to survive in the wilderness, how to track prey and find drinkable water. He knows more about hunting from a wolf's perspective than a human's, but he figures it's no bad thing if Styles is a little more wolf than most. Their tans become more natural than store-bought. From Albuquerque, they head north, to Denver. It's winter, and they stay inside most of the time. Styles reads voraciously, books on every subject and at every academic level. He learns best when he can skip around, Peter discovers. Peter doesn't want to risk getting Adderall on the black market, but a few extra cups of coffee seems to help him focus. So he reads about biology and geography and technology. He does push-ups and pull-ups and jumping jacks. Omaha is where Styles learns about grifting. They end up with the next-door neighbor at the extended stay hotel who's nosy but not too bright. Peter can play her like a violin, and before long, so can Styles. He teaches Styles about how to ask questions and get information without people catching on to the fact that he's snooping. After a while, Styles knows secrets to half a dozen different tenants. He knows about how the man in room 304 is there because his wife threw him out. He was cheating on her with three different women. The family in 207 is undocumented. The woman in 218 is hiding from an abusive ex-boyfriend. And the couple in 110 are keeping two cats, even though the building forbids pets. Peter spends most of their time in Omaha tense and ready to run, because it's inevitable one of them will eventually recognize Styles. He watches the way people look at Styles, waits for that sudden increase in heart rate, sharp intake of breath, as they make the connection. They stay at that hotel a little longer than he usually would, just so Styles can get more practice. On the 24th day, a newer tenant says, "You know, you look familiar. I can't quite put my finger on it." Styles smiles and spins an easy lie about how he was on a TV commercial for a local dentist. He and Peter are gone 20 minutes later. They work 6 days a week. Peter might not be familiar with child rearing, but he knows that everyone needs an occasional break. So one day a week, Styles doesn't work out or have lessons or read the books Peter has gotten him. They binge watch TV on Netflix or play video games. Styles itches to leave the apartment, asking to go places like the arcade or the mall. "It's still too early," Peter tells him. He's watching the media pick apart the mysterious case of the vanishing deputy's son. There's a lot of interest. When that has subsided, Styles will be able to go outside on his own. Styles grumbles sometimes, but for the most part, he accepts Peter's judgment. He takes to reading about the various investigations into his disappearance. Sometimes Peter finds him crying, but Styles never wants to talk about it. Peter knows it can't be easy, reading about the people from his old life, knowing that they're still looking for him. But for a 10-year-old, his resolve is made of steel. He never falters. Once, and only once, he asks Peter to take him to the police station to drop him off so he can go home. Peter does. But when they get there, Stiles shakes his head and says, "I just wanted to know if you'd actually do it." "Devious little cricket," Peter replies, rubbing a hand over Stiles' hair affectionately. "That's me," Stiles says. He's silent while Peter pulls out of the police station parking lot, then says, "You said I could change my mind, but I didn't think to ask what would happen if you changed your mind." "I won't," Peter says. Stiles' nose wrinkles. "What makes you think I might, but you can't? It's because I'm a kid, isn't it?" "Obviously, it's because you're a kid," Peter says, amused. Stiles gives a little huff. "Fine, but if you do change your mind and want to try to be normal or whatever, you can send me home. Just drop me off at a police station."
"Would you actually go home if I did that?" Peter asks.
For a few moments, Stiles is silent. Then he says, "I guess I would. It's not like I'd have anywhere else to go." Peter says.
"Well, don't worry about it. I'm not going to change my mind."
"Okay," Stiles says, and it never comes up again. From Omaha, they head north and end up in Milwaukee. That's where Peter starts teaching Stiles how to fight. He's terrible at it at first. He falls over a lot, trips over his own feet, flails and stumbles, but he gets better, and he's stronger than he looks. He loves learning the physics of it, learning how to use his opponent's momentum against them. Peter teaches him to be brutal, to go for vulnerable places with maximum force. Stiles actually manages to hurt him a few times, although he always heals quickly. They leave Milwaukee earlier than scheduled due to a chance run-in with a police officer at a grocery store. He probably had no idea who they are, but it's better not to take chances. Peter wakes up to the noise of Stiles coughing. He'd noticed earlier that day that Stiles seemed a little tired, and his scent was slightly different than usual. He hadn't given it much thought, but when the coughing fit doesn't subside, he gets up. He's taken aback by exactly how bad Stiles looks. He's drawn and pale, and his body is hunched over as he tries to stop coughing. "I'm fine," he says raggedly when he sees Peter, but then starts coughing again.
"You're very clearly not fine," Peter says, and feels his forehead. It's hot to the touch. "Is this a normal thing?"
Stiles chokes out a laugh.
"For humans, yeah, sometimes." "Is there something we should do about it?"
"Nuh-uh." Stiles bends over, coughing fitfully.
"Just want to sleep."
Peter frowns but nods, letting Stiles go back to bed. But it's difficult to sleep, listening to the noise of Stiles tossing, turning, and coughing. The next morning, when the cough is rattling dimly in Stiles' lungs over cereal that he's stirring more than eating, Peter asks,
"How long will this go on?"
"I don't know, a couple days?" Stiles looks somewhat listless, but interested, as he asks,
"Have you really never seen someone be sick before?"
"Not up close." Peter pours himself a mug of coffee, thinking back. One of Talia's children had been human. She must have gotten sick once or twice. But if so, Peter doesn't remember witnessing it. He watches Stiles hack up some phlegm and holds back disgust.
"It can't be healthy to just not do anything about this."
There's a flash of amusement in Stiles' face, and he says, "I need cough syrup and Tylenol. That'll bring down my fever, okay?" "Okay." Relieved that there's something he can do, Peter stands up and heads to the pharmacy, only to find himself stymied as soon as he gets there. Why are there so many different kinds of cough syrup? They can't all be different. Which one does Stiles need? He tries reading the labels, but it doesn't really help.
"You look lost," a voice says, and Peter glances up to see a middle-aged woman smiling at him.
"Let me guess, your wife sent you?"
"That would be impressive, since she died last year," Peter replies. The woman's eyes go wide. I'm so sorry, she says, and hastily moves down the aisle. Peter realizes, almost too late, that he's passing by an opportunity to talk to someone who probably knows more about this than he does. No, I'm sorry. That was uncalled for. It's just that this is the first time my son has been sick since she died, and I really don't know what he needs. Maybe you could help? Oh, of course, the woman says. How old is he? 11. And he's got a cough? And a fever, yes. It's only been going on about a day, but it's hard to watch our kids suffer, she says with a kind smile. She looks over the shelves of medicine quickly, then picks out a bottle of cough syrup and a box of children's Tylenol. Just follow the instructions on the boxes. The good news is that once he's 12, he can take the adult stuff, so you can just give him whatever you would take when you get sick. Great, Peter says, hoping he doesn't sound sarcastic. Make sure to keep him hydrated, the woman says, waving over her shoulder after Peter thanks her. How? Peter mutters, but stops by the grocery to grab a box of popsicles. Stiles smiles a bit when he sees them. He takes the cough syrup and then the Tylenol, eats two popsicles, and then falls fast asleep. Peter sits with him, smoothing his hand down over Stiles' hair, watching him sleep. In Columbus, Ohio, they take a break from physical fighting and focus on first aid and anatomy. Stiles learns about different natural remedies and poisons. They talk about how to steal medication and how to forge prescriptions. Peter makes sure to teach him what werewolves are vulnerable to. He's going to be tracking hunters. He needs to know how they think and what they do. From there, they head to Charlotte. Stiles learns about surveillance and counter-surveillance, about photography and lock-picking. He's running several miles a day, and he's putting on muscle through his sparring sessions with Peter. Summer arrives, so they leave the South, landing at a cheap hotel in Albany. Peter starts teaching him how to drive, although he has to sit on a cushion and put a block on the accelerator. It's good to know in a pinch, he says, despite his age. He learns about the mechanics of a car, too, not just how to keep one running, but how to disable those of his enemies. They enjoy the summer more than Peter would have expected. They go swimming a lot at the many lakes in the area. Stiles takes up rock climbing, and they spend several days at a time in the forest. He realizes, almost too late, that they might be getting a little too feral, disconnected from humanity, when he catches people giving them odd looks at the grocery store. So when the summer is over, they head back to civilization, settling down in a brownstone apartment in Brooklyn. Peter has paid extra for the prime real estate, but it's hardly worth it, as they're almost never there. Stiles soaks in the sights and sounds of New York City, spending days at a time in the libraries and museums. It's a little off topic, perhaps, but he's enjoying himself, and Peter thinks that a broad education is important in any case. In the Big Apple, nobody cares about asking, shouldn't you be in school? Stiles learns how to take the subway by himself, but Peter follows at a safe distance. Stiles always knows he's there. The first time he manages to give Peter the slip, Peter takes him out for a milkshake afterwards. It's been a year. Peter told himself he wouldn't focus on it, wouldn't make a big deal out of the anniversary of the fire. He doesn't know if Stiles even recalls the exact date his father had been murdered. But as it draws closer, he finds himself focusing on it more often than not. His baby would be 6 months old by now, or thereabouts. He wonders what the child would have been like. For the first time in his life, he wishes he was human, so he could turn to alcohol to dull the worst of the pain. Stiles is quiet for several days beforehand. Although Peter supposes that there's a 10-day difference between their respective losses. The anniversary of the fire passes without either of them mentioning it. But it occurs to Peter afterwards that Stiles might not mourn the same way as him. The day before the anniversary of Noah Stilinski's death, Peter sits Stiles down and says, "Is there something you'd like to do tomorrow? Anywhere you'd like to go?" Stiles looks down and shakes his head. No, I was thinking I kind of wished I didn't remember the day. It's like, just... He clears his throat. I already feel awful about it every day. I don't want to set aside a day to feel extra awful about it. I feel the same way, Peter admits. That's why I didn't want to do anything on my birthday either, Stiles says. Or Christmas. Or maybe any holiday ever again. I don't know. Maybe it'll get better? His voice chokes a little as he says it. Maybe, Peter says. Though, privately, he doubts it. But thanks for asking, Stiles adds. If I were at home, I might bring flowers to the graves. But I know we can't go back to Beacon Hills, so I guess it doesn't really matter. Peter says, thinking of the ceremony where the ashes had been scattered. His throat aches suddenly, with the effort of holding back tears. He wonders what Olivia would think of Stiles, of this random child that he had adopted. She would like him, Peter thinks. Olivia loved children, especially smart ones. She and Stiles probably would have gotten along like a house on fire. And what would Noah Stilinski think of him? Doubtless he wouldn't approve. Peter thinks of everything Stiles has said about his father, about his firm resolve and commitment to justice. No. Stilinski wouldn't approve of their mission at all, he thinks. He wonders if Stiles realizes that, if Stiles ever thinks about that. He supposes that it doesn't matter. It's not like Stilinski is around to take his son back. His approval or disapproval is entirely meaningless. Do you think heaven and hell are real? Stiles asks out of nowhere. Peter has to clear his throat before speaking. I'm not sure, to be honest. In the strict religious sense, I doubt it. But one isn't a werewolf without believing that there's a lot more to life than we see. I'm sure that something happens after death. I just don't have the faintest idea what. I hope that it's something good, Stiles says. Like, I told myself, just afterwards, that at least my mom and dad were together again. My dad missed my mom a lot. Feeling a sudden kinship with the late Noah Stilinski, Peter nods. I'm sure he did. So I hope they're together now. Stiles wipes his eyes. And someday I'll see them again. Peter nods, thinking about that. About the idea of being reunited with Olivia. That, of course, presumes that he deserves to go to heaven. But he still feels very unsure of the concept of souls being split up by their inherent worth. So perhaps he will see her again. Someday. Probably someday soon, if he's going to be realistic about their chances taking on every hunter in North America. But then a thought occurs to him, and a sob wells up in his throat. He can't hold it back before Stiles notices, and the boy looks at him with somewhat widened eyes. Are you okay? Peter can barely strangle the words out. He knows that this isn't something to say to a child, but he has no one else to confide in, so it comes out nonetheless. Maybe someday I'll see Olivia again, but I'll never meet our child. I don't think, whatever the afterlife is, I'm pretty sure that people who weren't born yet don't exist there, so... Oh. Stiles hesitates, then reaches out and leans his head against Peter's shoulder. I'm really sorry. I know it doesn't help, but I am. Peter nods, trying to measure his breathing until he can force the pain and grief back into the box where he normally keeps it. How can he miss someone he never met, never knew? He doesn't know, but the death, the non-existence of his child, is somehow more painful than losing the others. His fingers dig into Stiles' arm, and Stiles makes a quiet noise. Shit. Peter says, letting go. Did I hurt you? A little. Peter gives a wan smile. Partly my fault. I'm always supposed to be on guard, and I wasn't. Oh, well. Peter lets out a breath, feeling some equilibrium return. I won't hold it against you. How about we go out and get some ice cream? Yeah! Stiles jumps to his feet. That sounds good. I need to learn more computers, Stiles tells him, after a long day at the library. He's demolishing a plate of food, and Peter has had to buy him new shoes twice since arriving in the city. I want to learn how to get into people's accounts and stuff like that. I can use it to learn about them, to track them. Okay, Peter says, and sends a few feelers out to the contacts he's stayed in touch with. It's a good idea, although one he hadn't been planning on addressing for a while. He knows that hunters use the dark web to coordinate with one another and exchange information. Access to those forums will be invaluable, but he's never had the patience for that sort of work. Peter's contacts point him to Boston, or more specifically, to Cambridge. He meets a professor from MIT and gives him a stack of cash, and the next thing he knows, Stiles is learning computers. He learns programming languages and phishing scams and how to clone cell phones. He even makes a few friends, teenagers who are learning the same things. But he never loses sight of his goal. Everything he learns, Peter knows that he's filing it into the correct place to help him take on the hunters. He'll be doing a computer assignment and casually remark, "If I can learn to bypass alarm systems, that'll help us a lot." Or he'll be timing one of his sprints and ask, "How much do you think regular hunters work out?" He never forgets why they're doing this, and neither does Peter. So when Peter says they've been in Boston long enough, he just nods and goes to pack his things. He never says a word about the people they're leaving behind. Peter finds himself surprised when his phone rings. He gave the number to a few people, contacts he trusts, but 99% of his correspondence is by text. He picks it up rather cautiously, saying, "Hello? Hi, Uncle Peter," a male voice says. "It's Derek." "Hello, Derek," Peter says, surprised but pleased. He'd given Laura his new number, but hasn't heard from either of his nibblings in the year and a half since the fire. "How are you?" "I'm okay, I guess," Derek says. "Look, I know you're kind of living off the grid, right? Moving around a lot?" "Something like that," Peter says. "Why do you ask?" "I need a place to crash for a week or two," Derek says. "Things here are kind of, I don't know, weird. It's hard to explain. I just need to get out of here for a bit." "Sure," Peter says. "We're in Nashville right now. Got a pencil?" Derek takes their address and says he'll be there that night. Peter tells Stiles that his nephew is coming to visit, and Stiles looks vaguely interested but mostly occupied with what he's doing. It's late by the time Derek gets in, knocking on the door of the apartment where Stiles and Peter have been living. He doesn't say much, and Peter doesn't ask him any questions. Their apartment is small, but Derek says he's fine sleeping on the sofa. Then he sees Stiles curled up on one corner with a thick book. "Who's that?" Amused, Peter says. "That's Stiles. Remember the deputy's son?" "I didn't realize he'd be here," Derek says. Stiles looks up at this. "What? You think he would have left me on the side of the road somewhere?" "No," Derek snaps. "I just didn't think you were serious about wanting to be Batman." "Who wouldn't want to be Batman?" Stiles asks and goes back to his book. Peter gives a snort. "Yes, he's still here, and he's doing very well in his quest to become Batman. That being said, it's also bedtime." Stiles wrinkles his nose, sticks his tongue out, and flounces into his room. "Brush your teeth!" Peter shouts after him, then sees Derek staring at him. "What?" "Nothing. It's just..." Derek looks away, his jaw trembling. "I shouldn't have come here. It was a mistake. I'm going to..." Peter gets a hold of Derek's wrist as he starts towards the door. "Derek, what is it?" "You sound like his father," Derek says, and Peter feels a little twist in his gut. "Like, you're telling him what his bedtime is and to brush his teeth, and you... The two of you have this apartment, have this life, just like Laura's made a life for herself. I can't do it. I thought it was just..." I thought Laura was the one who was weird. I was angry at her for being okay. But you're okay too, which means it's me who's...
He can't finish the sentence. Peter silently draws him down onto the sofa so they're sitting next to each other. Once Derek has fallen silent, he says, "Did you see the book Stiles is reading? It's about serial killers. How they think, how they behave. Because hunters are, in many ways, like serial killers. It's heavy reading for a 12-year-old. He threw up while he was reading about Jeffrey Dahmer. But he keeps going because he's not okay. This apartment, it came furnished. These things aren't ours. I paid cash under the table, and next week we'll be gone. Neither of us are okay, Derek. I don't know how things are with Laura, but trust me, neither Stiles nor I fit anyone's description of okay. We're just focused on doing what we need to do."
Derek lets out a breath. "Oh," he finally says.
"What's going on with Laura?"
Peter asks.
"She has a boyfriend," Derek says. "Ah, and he's an asshole?" "No, that's the worst part. He's actually really nice. He's doing his senior year in college, and after he graduates, he's going back to his pack upstate. He invited us to come with him. Laura wants to, but the thought of having a pack again makes me sick. I can't do it. She told me that I needed to move on, that she wasn't going to give up something wonderful because I couldn't handle it."
Peter nods slightly. He can see where Laura's coming from, but his sympathies lie with Derek.
"I can't tell you what to do about Laura. All I can say is that you're welcome here any time, as long as you like."
"Okay, thanks."
Derek sleeps on the sofa for a few days, and sometimes helps Stiles with his lessons. Stiles is a little wary of him at first, afraid that Derek will make fun of him. But Derek treats Stiles and his goals completely seriously. A little less than a week has gone by before Peter gets up one morning to find Derek on the phone.
"Okay," he's saying as Peter comes into the room. "If you're sure, I'll see you tomorrow."
He hangs up and Peter says,
"Laura?"
"Yeah, she called to ask when I was coming home, and she's upset. I guess she thought I wasn't coming back ever."
Derek hugs his arms over his stomach and says,
"She needs me."
He's obviously expecting Peter to argue with him, but all Peter says is, "Then let's get you home." Peter is in the middle of a lecture on the different methods hunters use to imprison werewolves when he sees Stiles idly drawing his finger through a pile of mountain ash. The substance is following his fingers as he draws patterns in the air. Peter stops talking and watches for a moment before saying,
"Are you doing that intentionally?"
"Huh? What?"
Stiles asks, and the mountain ash dissolves into a little cloud and falls to the table. Peter can't help but smile, pleased that he had been right back at the Nemeton.
"I guess it's time to start your magical training."
"My what now?" Stiles asks, his eyes going wide.
They head to New Orleans. Peter has an old friend, an old flame, actually, who practices there as a voodoo priestess. Stiles is skeptical about the idea of voodoo, and Peter ends up teaching him a great deal about the religion, the differences between the different types practiced and the cultural influences on each.
"Voodoo isn't the best match for you, to be honest," he says, "because it's intensely tied to the religious aspects. But Eleanor is one of the few people I'm still in touch with who might be able to teach you. And if she thinks it won't work, she'll refer us to someone else."
Eleanor decides after 3 days that Stiles isn't a candidate to become a voodoo priest. Voodoo is dependent on mysticism, on connecting with spirits. Stiles is too practical. His magic needs to be more concrete than that. She suggests they try Wicca and recommends somebody who lives in Vermont. For the first time, Peter breaks their rule about living in a city. Stiles isn't sure how he feels about the god and goddess aspect of Wicca, but he takes to the magical aspects like a duck to water. He's starting to get good at it when he learns about the law of threefold return,
which spooks him.
So if I use magic to harm others, he says that night to Peter, it gets visited back on me threefold. It's like karma, but worse.
Most magical systems have some form of karma, Peter tells him, but I wouldn't worry about it.
Why not?
Stiles asks, his forehead wrinkling.
Karma is the idea of what goes around comes around, Peter says. And if you hurt an innocent person, sure, karma would kick your ass. But you're not hurting innocent people. You're hurting guilty people. So the conclusion is that sometimes you get what's coming around, but sometimes you are what's coming around.
Stiles thinks about that for a long moment before he nods.
Okay, he says. That makes sense.
In Baltimore, Stiles learns the beginning of knife fighting and firearms. In Jacksonville, he practices breaking and entering at dozens of houses. In Austin, he reads law books and feeds stray cats. In Las Vegas, he practices grifting on unwitting tourists. Somewhere close to his 15th birthday, Peter decides he's ready.